Welcome, Dementoids and Dementites, to the Reason Roundtable podcast, your weekly jolt of libertarianism brought to you by the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets, which you should totally subscribe to. I am Matt Welch, subbing in for a vacationing Peter Suderman, and joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and sixth man of the year in the podcast world, Mike Heska. Gracias, Miguel, for joining us. And let's just go straight to it. The Iran deal. So we taped this podcast about 6 hours before it is posted, which is perilous in a good week and then on a bad week. The variance of possible outcomes with the Iran war, and I'm still trying to figure out how to pronounce that country's name, is that it could be all over. It could be negotiated. In fact, Iran could join the Abraham Accords, according to Donald Trump. Or we could be doing a big war all over again because they're already shooting at each other in the Strait of Hormuz. So given that variance, Catherine, I thought maybe you could lead us in a round of discussion about what did we learn from this particular war? What's a useful lesson that we can think about the next time we decide to go blow some stuff up?
We didn't learn a goddamn thing. Matt, thank you so much for asking. We will be making this mistake again. The headline at the top of the New York Times right now says, tensions rise as Iran threatens to retaliate against U.S. strikes. I don't know what the U.S. strikes are since it's sort of a ceasefire, but sort of not. I don't know what the retaliation would be. Nobody does, really. Marco Rubio says talks are ongoing, which is now the least reassuring phrase in the English language. And we learned nothing. We're going to make this same mistake again. We're going to think we know better than the rest of the world. We're going to try and fix it from afar and end up worse off than we began.
You don't sound like you're being very helpful.
Sorry.
Constructive.
You know what else isn't helpful? What's that? This whole war, the whole thing from start to finish, unhelpful.
Nick Gillespie, what is a lesson that you take from all of this besides Catherine's very nihilistic and unproductive suggestion that we're always screwed?
Yeah, you know, this is a war of choice, and it was a bad choice at the beginning, you know, when it started in whatever, late March or late February, early March. It is not the continuation of, you know, a nonstop act of aggression since 1979. We did, you know, Trump, it's not we. Trump did not build a consensus. He does not have a clear set of goals for this. It should not be comforting to anybody that Marco Rubio, who you mentioned about an hour ago, said, we're not going to sign a deal unless it's a good deal. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the Secretary of State, as well as 45 other offices in the federal government. If that's the best you can say about something, this was not good. And to double down on what Catherine was talking about, we did not learn the lessons of the past 20 years in American foreign policy. And I hope we're not doomed to repeat it. This time it is not, you know, first time it's tragedy, second time it's farce. This isn't a farce, deeply disturbing. And I think, unfortunately, the Trump administration has kind of backed itself into a corner where it can't really end things without regime change. But there is almost certainly no way to induce a regime change in Iran without a massive escalation, which I could also see him doing, which would be disastrous for everyone.
Talked of Rubio's comment. Doesn't he have to say that? Doesn't the Secretary of State or anyone in the Trump administration
have to? He could shut up. But it's like you can actually, you know, say here is what would make a good deal other than unconditional surrender of Iran. It's just the rationale for this war kept changing even as the first set of bombs were dropping, and it continues to. So, you know, without knowing why we got in the war or how we would end it in a credible way, it's a long, slow bleed that's not going to get better anytime soon.
Pesca, were you cautiously optimistic at any point? Did you support this or at least have hope that it would work on those early morning hours of March 1st?
Hope, yeah. Optimistic, maybe more so than some sort of consensus of the blob. But I think that we're not going to sign a deal unless it's a good deal should be true of every deal. In fact, it should be unstated about every deal if you're the United States. What I learned, to answer your question, Matt, the first one, is that it's worth a try is an inadequate criteria of an operation of this magnitude and method, and especially of an operation undertaken by Donald Trump. Now, it's worth a try. Might have been okay with Maduro in Venezuela. Maybe not. Maybe it just worked out. And so that's why we think it was worth a try.
Did it, though? Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, these are good questions. It certainly seems to have worked out in that that's the one that they point to as the success. But it's worth a try. Maybe could never work with Donald Trump, but I don't think it could work with present day Donald Trump, who's in his YOLO and no care or consideration for the possibility of second or third order effects. So just take one example. When it started and the articulation was, I hope the population rises up, I said to myself, I don't know what I don't know. Maybe the CIA has been planting the seeds of this. And it seems not to have been the case at all. It was just a hope. And there were a number of things of this magnitude, like maybe the Strait of Hormuz won't be this choke point linchpin of geopolitics that we always thought it was. But that also seems not to have been considered. Is that even a second order effect? That's like a 1.1 order effect when you bomb Iran. So it's worth a try. Couldn't work in this situation. Definitely not with this guy.
Catherine, before I ask a follow-up question to Mike Pesca, do you score on the choke point linchpin metaphor?
Hate that so much.
I think
we can't
great.
Be linchpinning and choke pointing in the same place. That's not even physically possible.
That's why there's nothing happening in the Strait of Hormuz except pain and the blocking of helium.
Yeah.
Which
it's a choke lynch. Yeah. Now, most lynching, you know, results in the breaking of the neck, but I think we're going with choke.
Imagine, you know, flash forward to, you know, August when kids' birthday parties can't get the helium they need for
to
balloons.
Thing like
you know, the Democrats are going to take everything.
And the nation's Zeppelin fleet will be horrifically depleted.
Yeah, no, I would like to just use this.
Oh, the humanity.
Yeah. No,
we call them blimps now because Zeppelins are Nazi tinged.
And tell people, do not ever suck gas directly from the helium machine that inflates balloons. You'll die. Happened to a kid at my school.
I'm sure.
But listen,
he was probably on a bunch of other things, Matt.
Yeah, did he die from the ingestion or by floating into utility lines?
Pesca, though, by pointing at Donald Trump, aren't you baking in kind of incompetence dodge? Like, isn't whatever is true about Donald Trump in this case that, like, you can't really trust him to do this is also true for Joe Biden, is also true for Barack Hussein Obama, is also true for kind of everybody. Like, Obama did Libya. And that worked until it didn't. Shouldn't we be learning a more structural lesson about the application of power, dude?
No, I don't think it's true that military applications can't work, or if they're ordered by the executive, they won't work. I think the somewhat limited bombing of Fordo and those facilities months ago did, quote unquote, work. And I think that there is a history of operations where you fully consider what the downsides are, but you also know what the exit strategies are. Sometimes they don't work in U.S. history, and sometimes they work so well we don't even really think about them, like Noriega.
That worked as at least introducing the...
If I may just follow up, Matt, on, you know, lessons not learned. In the prep for this, you talked about a Ted Cruz tweet.
Yeah.
Where Ted Cruz is raising, you know, stately concerns, statesmanship concerns about all of this. But his answer was basically, we really need to get serious and start destroying the country. This is what worries me the most, is that you know, it's not just that we don't learn lessons from this, but all of the people who have some access to power learn the dumbest version of their lesson, of the knowledge and wisdom they had going into a situation. So I think you might see, insanity on the part of Trump, you know, just like who knows what happens. But then on a kind of neoconish right, you're just going to see, you know, the real problem is that we didn't bomb enough countries, that we didn't occupy enough countries. And that worries me.
Pursuant to this, Catherine, and you can talk because I was going to throw it to you anyways, but
okay.
It's very difficult to consult my notes, as you know, because my computer will shut down. So I have to look
all
on
right.
the phone, which is
it's your computer's fault, Matt.
Yeah.
Thanks, Grandpa.
I want you to respond to a tweet exchange, Catherine, because that's always good content for us. Mike Pompeo, pursuant to what Nick just said, tweeted out, the deal being floated with Iran seems straight out of the Wendy Sherman, Robert Malley, Ben Rhodes playbook. Pay the IRGC to build a WMD program and terrorize the world, not remotely America first. It's straightforward. Open the damn strait. Deny Iran I can't do it. Access to money, take out enough Iranian capability so it cannot threaten our allies in the region. Let's go. To which was responded by the White House Director of Communications, Stephen Chung. Mike Pompeo has no idea what the fuck he's talking about. Wow. He should shut his stupid mouth.
You're just making those not
your mouth. So,
I'm mad that you just made me laugh at that. Like, I know we're supposed to be the, I mean, are we supposed to be the grownups in the room? I sometimes feel like I need to be the grownup in the room, and I can't be a grownup in that room anyway. So, I mean, it is true that that does not seem to me to be the right path. And I guess to foreshadow some of what we will maybe talk about later in the show, there seems to be this real conflation between the idea of what sort of powerful and thoughtful, like kingly statesmanship would be versus just the kind of like alpha male warrior nonsense that the Trump administration has like fallen into here. There's like a, you know, oh, are we like a global power who rules justly and wisely in a far-seeing way? Or are we just like the largest, loudest idiot in the room? And largest, loudest idiot is real popular and has always been in foreign policy.
Can I offer one word in defense of Pompeo and his psychology? Remember, he was reportedly almost assassinated by Iran. Right. Iran nearly succeeded in orchestrating the assassination of Mike Pompeo in Europe in 2022. Josh Dawsey's book revealed. So, yeah, you got to give him like 10% leeway.
He can be annoyed. Here, he's allowed to get a little more aggro.
I also
little more skin in the game than the rest of us. And skin is loose with Pompeo. He's loving it.
And he did it the old fashioned way. Right. Gastric bypass. I do want to give Trump, before we leave this topic, Matt, I do want to give Trump, maybe he was foreseeing, and he created the best possibility for not going to a destination wedding of a family member in human history, right? And he knew this was coming a year ago. You know, that's when it probably started with the bombing of Iran back last year.
I think so
give him credit for that.
Among the many,
I call it the Bettina Accords.
The many, many gifts that Donald Trump, love him or hate him, has given to us, you know, including shutting, like complete and total shutdown until we figure this all out kind of stuff. And then also the late Barney Franks, a very disrespectful shirt. but saying in his tweet about, or his Truth Social, or I think maybe it's just comments about not going to the son's wedding. He's like, I've been around him a lot. I'm going to absolutely use that when I don't pay for my daughter's wedding at all. My quick lesson from what we learned from all this is that with great power comes the irresistible temptation to use it. Just like it's a structural issue. If you're the biggest thing, if there's the big button on your desk, you're going to push the button. There's just no way that that doesn't happen, or at least that it hasn't happened, even though almost every president since the end of the Cold War who has won election has been the least interventionist of the major party candidates, possible exception of Joe Biden. The second axiomatic thing that's connected to that is that every battlefield success leads directly to a strategic failure, or at least often a not. As Pesca was saying, that's Venezuela. We've seen this all with the reporting about all of this, is that Trump thought that he could do Venezuela in Iran, which is really stupid, really, 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 really dumb idea. But that's what happens. Like, oh, wow, that worked. So let's do this. And now thinking, of course, of doing the same thing in Cuba, which is maybe a little bit more like Venezuela, but also not for a variety of reasons. Okay.
Boy, if there's,
go ahead. You go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if there's ever an argument for paying an infirm old regime to leave and never come back, that's Cuba.
Just bribe that family. Get Raulito on the case. All right. Next Tuesday, so a week from today, there's going to be an election for LA mayor, which has kind of caught the nation's attention, or at least among people who are political obsessives on Twitter or wherever else people go these days, because of Spencer Pratt, the second ranked candidate behind incumbent mayor Karen Bass. He's a reality TV show guy who has been, I think, investing like zero money in actual advertisements, just like cranking out and retweeting AI like art about the campaign, about the dystopian LA governance and such like. A lot of people are excited about his candidacy. There's also another woman named Nithya Raman, I believe is how you say her name when I don't have notes in front of me, who is likely to push this into a runoff if nobody gets to the 50% threshold. I was struck over the weekend by just kind of a preponderance of tone in coverage about Spencer Pratt as he is doing things. So Rolling Stone magazine noted expertise in California politics, said that history tells us Spencer Pratt can't fix Los Angeles. A friend of Podcast and Reason, Gustavo Arellano, says that, quote, Pratt's loudest fans fundamentally loathe modern day L.A. Strong stuff. The L.A. Times says that L.A. is safer than it's been in decades, but crime is an issue that's dominated the mayor's race. And people are spending a lot of time sort of tone policing that in interviews when he's asked about the homeless problem, he says they're all a bunch of drug addicts. And they're like, that's not nice to the unhoused. I've seen a lot of people worried about pictures of like people making OK signs because it's obviously white power. Pesca, you're the most adjacent to being a lib on this podcast. Have we learned nothing in 11 years? It's just like the same stupid reaction to Trump. And now we're doing it in LA.
I mean, just by the fact that he will definitely not be going to Ghana, Spencer Pratt positions himself as the second most likely person to run that city. So it's very hard to consider Spencer Pratt without considering the failures of Karen Bass, who is probably still going to win. You know, she's 80% in the prediction markets and up in the polls. And it's just such a dominantly Democratic city. And if you're going to have a Republican come in, he has to be a certain kind of Republican, which is not a Spencer Pratt Republican. So what I think Spencer Pratt does is symbolizes in the best light a lot of the legitimate angst of real Angelenos who don't loathe L.A., which would be, you know, the worst follow-up song to a hit ever.
Although Randy Newman, does he loathe L.A.? Maybe.
I don't know. Like awesome. He could maybe. I want to see the Pixar movie where that's the theme song. Yeah. So Spencer Pratt is this reality star who you would think doesn't raise serious points, and when you watch him in interviews, is very truculent and takes on the interviewer if he senses the interviewer challenges him in a non-serious way. And I guess is trying to do with AI videos what the Iranians did with the Lego videos. I mean, if it's working for them, it could work for him. So you add up all that stuff and it just seems, to many people, I don't know about our friend Megan Downham, for instance, but to many people, it seems like totally unserious candidate. Guy is just a symptom of all that is wrong in politics. And maybe you could say, you know, there's going to be some sort of expression of anti-Bass sentiment. But I think he's on to a couple things. And I think his analysis of the homeless is maybe goes over the top to get attention, but has a lot more truth to it than the NGO way of thinking of the homeless, which is not solving the homeless problem. So, I mean, you know, let's just say a valuable backward walking god of Hopi legend.
Nick, did you see any person that we know personally weigh in on this campaign about Spencer Pratt?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, friend of Reason, Drew Carey, said on Threads, which it's nice to see somebody using that as like a primary platform, I suppose. But he said, fuck this guy. And he said Spencer Pratt is a serial grifter and you really can't be seriously thinking of voting for him. I think on a profound level, he's correct. And if any of us watch The Hills or remember Spencer Pratt from that, I mean, he is a jackass. He's a professional jackass. But Matt, to your point, and I guess to Mike's as well, Spencer Pratt, you know, is almost certainly not going to be the mayor. He would almost certainly be terrible because he doesn't have any kind of administrative, experience or anything like that. But it really is important to understand why he is even in the conversation. And you know, the interviews I've seen with him where he's really compelling is when he's, you know, standing in his RV parked in Pacific Palisades where his house burned down and nothing has happened since whenever that happened, you know, 1,000 years ago or something like that. As somebody who's lived in L.A. and I love L.A. and I love modern L.A. where it's just, you know, mixing and roiling and, you know, bizarre and shifting out of Hollywood into other types of, industries and things like that. You know, there is something tragic about a major American city, a definitive American city that cannot get a local government that isn't completely idiotic and incompetent and spendthrift. So, you know, I think the question is, like, will the power establishment in LA learn anything from this in the way that it seems like the establishment in San Francisco learned from its ultra woke, ultra stupid governance of the past 20 or 25 years? And unfortunately, I don't think that's happening.
Catherine, Nick name checked Frisco. Can you think of any other place in America right now where the reform is happening from within the House? I mean, we're talking about reelecting Karen Bass. Like, Karen Bass was like Ghana, like the mayor and the one like deal in the Pacific Palisades that was empty that shouldn't have been empty, and the incompetence and just everything associated with that. You know, they reelected Gavin Newsom. They protected him from a recall. Bro was like bulldozing sand onto skate parks during COVID and eating at the French Laundry. And he won by saying that Donald Trump is a meanie. And people are like, yep, I'm not gonna do that. Is there any other place where you can see this, like people saying, oh, you know what? We've governed badly. Let's change course within our party.
I mean, it seems like the main thing that is happening all over the country is either one, do you or do you not like Donald Trump? Obviously, we saw that in the Massey race in Kentucky. We saw that in the state Senate races in Indiana or wherever that was. Like, there's the Trump, everything is a Trump referendum thing. And that tragically is like a huge part of it. And then, you know, I think there's just the politics as punditry thing. Like, Spencer Pratt, I guess, might be okay in some of his analysis about what's going on at the TV soundbite level of LA. And that's the case for him. But that's not a case for being the mayor of a city. That's the case for getting a Fox News contract or whatever. And I think that those two things are the main thing that's happening. And I don't see any evidence of like, hey, here's my resume and I could fix this city in practical ways. Here they are. And then people are like, yeah, we want that. Let's vote for that. I just don't see that happening anywhere in the country right now. I mean, maybe it's happening in like small towns that I have no visibility into. Maybe the dog catcher elections in Des Moines are like going really well on substantive governance. I hope so. That would be great. But I don't know.
That's an open call for all listeners and viewers of this podcast to email us with examples, because we want to feel
yeah.
hope.
Yeah. Even well, I would like to be happy.
I mean, this may not be quite exactly what you're looking for, but if you look at Texas has like 4 of the 10 largest cities in the country. And when you look at places like Houston and Austin in particular, and Houston, longtime Republican stronghold, has been Democratic in leadership for a while. City Austin is like this too, where you have a Democratic city, you know, a blue city in a red state. Kind of decent governance starts to happen because they're not, you know, fixated on kind of racial purity or anything like that. They tend to be pretty pragmatic about things like homelessness, but also on like building policy and zoning and things like that. Houston has its own interesting kind of, you know, long history and basically letting it rip all the time. But, you know, this is, you know, to me, this is the question. Is there a way to replicate that in states that are more monocultural? And you have just in places like Florida where, and Florida, it may be changing, but you have places like Miami that, you know, longtime Republican kind of stronghold, now more Democratic. So it's, you know, in a deeply red state. Things seem to be working, but it seems like you need that kind of friction. You're not going to do it from the same party.
As far as the Texas cities, where rents are coming down in Austin and Dallas, it does help not to have supply constraints as a near religion. And so you definitely don't have that in LA, which is a major part of the problem. But Catherine, one thing that you said, I do think that the describer of the problem has a major leg up in today's politics. Yeah. And that's essentially Donald Trump's gift. He vividly describes the problem. And so it probably won't work in LA because someone who's an avowed Republican, not a moderate business-oriented Republican or conservative, is never going to win. And then you blame, all right, where is the pressure from Bass going to come? And you just mentioned Nithya Raman. But you know, a couple of years ago, she got a lot of attention for blaming Toyota for making their catalytic converters too easy to steal.
Yep.
So this wasn't the only policy position she has ever had, but this is who we're drawing from to possibly pressure Karen Bass to get better governance. It doesn't seem the San Francisco example, where some more moderate challenger emerged, didn't happen in LA. And maybe there's something, Nick, what you were talking about the crazy schizoid nature of the city that doesn't allow it to happen. But it's sad for the city, I do think.
Also, can we just pause and appreciate his name is literally Pratt.
Yeah.
Like that, if you wrote this as a novel, your editor would be like, calm down, change the name of this character. It's just so anyway.
We are going to go to our listener question of the week here in a moment. But first, you're going to listen to an ad read by Peter Suderman.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Are you having a tough time? You sometimes feel alone, like there's no one who understands, no one you can talk to. Well, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and it's a reminder that whatever you're going through, you don't have to go through it alone. Having someone with you to listen, to understand, to support you, it can make all the difference in the world. And look, I get it. Sometimes I can't sleep. I have racing thoughts. It's like there is a podcast in my head and it never, ever ends. And it's really hard to turn off. But one way to deal with that is to talk to someone else. So if you're feeling overwhelmed, if you're feeling stuck or anxious, therapy can help. And that is where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists. They work according to a strict code. BetterHelp uses a short questionnaire to match you with a therapist who understands your needs and can help with your goals. And if you want to talk to someone else, you can switch at any time. BetterHelp has over 30,000 therapists who have served more than 6 million people globally. It is the world's largest online therapy platform, and it works. There's an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. This is sponsored by BetterHelp.
A reminder to email your queries to roundtable@reason.com. Is that podcast@reason.com? Either one. We'll probably get there.
Matt Welch at reason.com.
Welch@reason.com. We love to hear them from you. This one comes from beloved listener John Haas from the aforementioned Texas. Asks, I am going through a stack of old things in my desk and came across an October 2024 Reason magazine about Project 2025. It's the one with the striking cover of MAGA hat people drowning in a sea of Trump hair. Shout out to Joanne. It got me thinking it would be an interesting time to reflect on this whole Project 2025 thing. It's 2026 now. What actually happened? Catherine, you edit this magazine. Answer the question.
Sometimes. Yep. First of all, congratulations on cleaning out your desk. I think it's an underappreciated task. And so good work there. We did like, I don't know, maybe half of Project 2025. Like I went and looked for some, you know, have people done kind of definitive look backs on this. And it does seem like if you are kind of conspiracy minded, as people were about Project 25, you could say, look, this, we were right to be scared. We were right to be paranoid. In fact, at least half the stuff in that book, they really tried to do. And that includes the kind of mass layoffs. It includes some DEI stuff. It includes immigration stuff, a little bit of abortion stuff, not as much as you would think. And none of the libertarian stuff that was in there, by the way, like no abolishing of the Department of Homeland Security, which was in there. That would be a wrong understanding of what happened. As we talked about on this podcast, as we talked about in that magazine, Project 2025 was mostly just regular Republican stuff. It was just it was the equivalent of a Republican Party platform. The Republican Party under Trump has shied away from doing formal platforms because the platform is just whatever Trump wants to do. But this idea that somehow, you know, oops, they said the quiet part loud and published their evil schemes, I think, you know, has proven to be not worth the hysteria it was given. I mean, you remember during the DNC when they had like that big fake book of Project 25 and they kept passing around this like giant kind of atlas sized book and saying like, this is, they gave us the plans and we have to fight them. They did some of the stuff in there. They did like half of it, but they would have done half of it even without the big evil book.
You know, those that big book, those were actually excess Epstein file binders that the Trump administration was putting together.
That's true. Nick, I have a muscle memory of us kind of.
You don't have any muscle memory at all, Matt Welch.
Just because I don't have muscle. Listen, it's a metaphor.
That's right. Yeah.
Muscle memories.
Okay.
He has a memory of having muscles. I've seen him shirtless.
The point of Matt's
muscle memory.
Yes. And also a linchpin.
And a piercing. A nipple piercing of muscle memory, Matt. Well,
still have Matt,
three
save
holes
us.
In the earlobes. I could get the dang
really?
Out the dream captures.
Yeah.
Anywho, I feel like we poo pooed Project 2025 on this podcast.
Yeah.
A bit. Were we wrong?
No. I mean, I think Catherine is, right that it was not a grand conspiracy. I don't think we quite saw, the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts kind of deep throating the Trump administration the way that he did, or particularly Tucker Carlson. For me, the takeaway, though, to go back to our wonderful reader and his question, the important thing from a reason point of view or a libertarian point of view is that absolutely none of the stuff about deregulating or about deconstructing the administrative state even pretended to happen. And like, didn't he dismantle the Department of Education? And yet it persists, right? It's like nothing has changed to move anything closer to a libertarian, good thing. And I think that's really important. I think about this with the Libertarian Party, which had its, annual convention or semi-annual convention over the weekend and things like that. If an organization is not explicitly libertarian and moving towards reducing the size, scope, and spending of government, it is not just not going to do that. It's going to go in the opposite direction. And I think that's the big lesson, that there is no reason to take Trump or the contemporary Republican Party that he leads at face value when they ever talk about reducing government.
I think that Slade's piece was actually pretty prescient in that she discussed, like, contextualized this Project 2025 as basically a personnel project, that there were competing personnel projects happening among the conservative think tanks of, like, how do you staff Trump 2.0 in a way that's different than Trump 1.0 with bigger loyalists and people who will not muck about and put sand in the gears, Catherine. And that was interesting at the time. I remember thinking, oh, that's clever. That's not how it's being discussed largely. And I think somehow that people not understanding what Slade understood then, I think is part of why Trump 2.0 has come as, in some ways a surprise, because it has removed friction from him. He's been able to do way more Trump things the second time around, and the amount of that, including, outright corruption, which we'll probably talk about in a second. But just like a lot of things, the tariffs, I'm just going to sign this executive order, all of this, he is acting a lot, acting out his desires a lot more. And I think Project 2025 is part of that because it focused on personnel. Pesca, do you want to confess your sins about what you got right or wrong about Project 2025?
Yeah, I think that maybe, well, no, but yes. I will say the cartoonishness of one's opponents does not vindicate the project. So yeah, they were reading these big stupid books at the DNC. I guess that's how they think that people vote. I mean, they were the people who nominated Kamala Harris, so what the fuck do they know? I talked to Franklin Foer, who wrote a big piece for The Atlantic called The Purge, which was 100 photos of civil servants who had been purged, and he points out that 300,000 fewer people work for the government at the end of Trump's first year in office than before. And a lot of these 300,000, I think we need like people who run the tsunami warning system. And I look at everything that happened with PEPFAR, and I don't know how many thousands people or tens of thousands might have died or had worse lives for pretty much pennies on our investment. You guys might disagree, but to me, as an American, not much is asked for me, but if you could solve some amount of AIDS in Africa, that's a good use of my tax dollars. So I have a lot of questions about Project 2025. Was it ever serious? Was this the best the Trump administration could do when you look at the Department of Education that wasn't dismantled? Yeah, they put a lot of bureaucrats on bureaucratic hold and then paid them back money and sometimes time and a half, thus costing us more money. I do think that there needs to be, and this probably will infuriate you, you know, we need to do this precisely and with a scalpel, not with a chainsaw. Mm-hmm. And on my show, I've talked 100 times, like, is that even possible? And if the chainsaw could happen and you could convince me that the destruction wrought has been worth it, I might sign on for a lot of that. But I do think Project 2025, everything I've talked about and Ford talked about, did have a big effect. And if libertarianism is smaller government, the government got smaller than it would have barring Project 2025.
Even though it hasn't been reduced by a single dollar, right?
No, it's been increased. Yeah. We're spending more than we were a year ago.
But part of that is the execution, and part of that is where we are with Trump's tariffs and other policies.
But Mike, you're also not saying that government can never get smaller because everything we're doing at any given moment in time is absolutely essential.
No, it's not. And Department of Education is a great department, I think, that you could do a lot with to cut away. Can you do it in that way? Can you do it through the rules they have with civil service? I don't even know. But there are definitely some places where, and not just abstractly, you and I can get together. Yeah. And let's say I were representing the Democratic side of things. I'd say I'm willing to give these 15% up. And it wouldn't just all be, you know, hated military spending. It would be so-called social spending. And some of the DEI stuff, by the way, I think was necessary. A lot of it.
And in general, it is worth noting, like, he did fire a lot of people that's real. And Christian Brichke has written about that in our pages. We are seeing many of those people, as Matt said, slowly reinstated with pay. But it probably won't come back to the same levels entirely. The fact that we're still pouring more and more and more money and somehow even getting fewer government actors for it feels like a worst of all worlds to me. Also, the fact that so many things are being done unofficially now. So, like, apparently the U.S., there's a story in the Post today that the U.S., the person who is interacting with Venezuela on behalf of the U.S., like, has no government job. Like, he's just there vibing out. And, you know, DOGE was done all kind of semi-outside of any kind of formal government system. That means we don't get checks. We don't get approvals. We don't get any of the things that might later be needed to rein in the powers of these people in the world.
It was name-checking Trumpian corruption. Previously, that's a segue into this segment, which is about the $1.776 billion slush fund, do we call it that? Anti-weaponization fund that the Trump administration negotiated with itself as part of the settlement of an IRS case lawsuit that Trump filed against the IRS. It's very confusing on, like, which side of the V are we on? We're on all sides of the V, apparently. But anyways, so Trump led to the settlement of this case about leaking his tax records, which is a case in which the guy who leaked it was actually prosecuted by the Biden administration. The settlement for this now is going into a fund, which is going to towards victims of a weaponization of government. It's widely expected to be basically people who were prosecuted on January 6th for rioting on Capitol Hill. It has led to a very odd thing, which is that some Republicans are criticizing it on the record, which is something we haven't seen a lot of on Capitol Hill. There's apparently a meeting last week with Attorney General Todd Blanche, in which
acting.
Does he have the job? Is he doing it? Yeah, he's Attorney General. Who used to be Trump's personal lawyer too. They expressed a lot of fury. Congress just decided to take its ball and go home and recess for a while based on this. So that's all kind of interesting. Let's go around and just get, like, what's one thing about this settlement, this fund, this whole process that is of interest to y'all? Pascal, why don't you lead us off?
Well, Ro Khanna said we need to make sure that anyone who attacked a cop doesn't get money, and also child molesters. And I was looking into it saying, were child molesters getting money? And no, it just, we don't want child molesters to get money. Jesus. This is horrific. The precedent, though existing for Obama, who created slush funds, shall we say, at least they were overseen by outside people, as opposed to the five appointees of this Trump slush fund who they might give one to in Congress. This is another hilarious thing is in front of Congress, in front of the Senate, where Republicans were grilling him. Todd Blanche, who, though a litigator, isn't great with the gab under pressure, though then again, arguably maybe Bondi and Christie no more. So perhaps we want a just normal talking guy. But he did say, you know, Hunter Biden could apply for this fund, thus making it, I guess, bipartisan, although I just saw Hunter Biden talking to Candace Owens about the Jews. This is bad, but at least it's transparently bad, which is why these senators who have now been liberated from pretending to like Trump, you know, after Trump campaigns against them, the Senate is now putting up a lot of roadblocks, which was like a choke point or a linchpin, but a little less permanent for this and the ballroom basement. So that's interesting to see some actual opposition within the Senate. I wonder if it'll stand.
Nick, Mike, just referenced the Obama era slush funds, which came as part of settlements of a couple of big class action lawsuits.
Right.
This has been tweeted out a lot by Ted Frank, a friend of the podcast, I would say, a conservative lawyer who was involved in some of those cases. And his contention is that, hey, you know, in many ways, those were worse because they were bigger and kind of gratuitous. You circulated a Politico piece casting a doubt on that. Do you have an interpretation of that particular fight and just sort of an opinion about what we should think about these types of slush funds?
Yeah, some of the, you know, slush funds by definition are not good, right? And the difference between the Obama era ones is that, as Pesca was saying, they came from actual class action settlements, and there was some oversight beyond the Obama administration or beyond Obama saying, okay, hey, you look like a good guy and you're not a child molester. Or, you know, if it's Obama, you are a child molester, so you get extra $50 or something, right? The idea that this kind of open-ended settlement that comes out of a case against Trump, it reminds me, there's an Orson Welles movie called Lady from Shanghai. It's like his third movie, one of the few that he actually finished. There's a scene in it where a crippled lawyer interrogates himself because he's both prosecuting the case and on trial. I recommend people go look for that because it's very funny, and it would be great to see Trump doing all of this. But part of this, the brazenness of it, Matt, you've talked about this at Reason events recently. Other people have talked about, you know, just the scale of the amount of money and corruption and self-dealing that Trump is doing is unparalleled. And you get to a certain point where it is not simply, well, there's a precedent for this. You know, Franklin Roosevelt's are four terms, you know, so like Trump could do eight. Or something. It's like where things go off the, you know, they go off the charts, and you've got to say, you know, this is just absolute bullshit. And anybody defending this is full of shit. That's it. You know, because, and it does, it's not good enough to say, oh, well, you know, Obama did it and George Bush did it. And, you know, Gerald Ford, what a fucking piece of shit. So now Donald Trump can do whatever he wants at whatever scale he wants forever and ever. It's like, no, you know, the proper, if Ted Frank is right, that those past settlements were bad, then he should be even more outraged that this is happening now in a completely unbridled way to give Donald Trump, already a billionaire, even more money to, you know, send a big gift to the son whose wedding he chose not to attend.
In fairness to Monsieur Frank, he has backed legislation to get rid of these slush funds. That would be an appropriate response. And I agree that would be an appropriate response in addition to, as Nick says, saying, hey, that's really, really bad. Stop defending it. Catherine, anything stick out on you besides that our own resident hero, Jacob Solem, has written a great column that everyone's going to read about this tomorrow?
Yes. Also, Billy Binion has written about this very profitably. No, I feel like I am being strangled to death by the monkey's paw. Like, we asked for the government to do something differently with respect to, you know, like over-criminalization and over-prosecution and overcharging and kind of the weaponization of the court system against against people who haven't done anything wrong. And instead we got this, which is like purports to be an answer to it. So like 6 years ago, we were like, let's reform qualified immunity. That way we could hold government actors who overstep their bounds accountable in a way that would make sense. And instead it was like, we are definitely not going to do that. We're going to do this thing where like Donald Trump's friends who don't like how they've been treated get money or something. I don't even know what's going to happen with this. This is basically the point that Billy made in his piece, and he's right. Like, it makes me feel crazy because it is in a totally distorted way responsive to a real problem. It's just the way that least recognizes how incentives work and the way that least produces like lasting reform that would eventually rein in the real thing, which is the weaponization of government and kind of over prosecution.
And it's worth pointing out the obvious here, which is that the recipients of the settlement money have absolutely nothing to do with the underlying lawsuit. Not connected.
Yes.
Nothing. Right. Nothing similar.
It's just a pile of money that now has a new destiny.
That's one of the big differences between this and previous settlements.
Right. All right. Let's
do. Well, you know, there were settlements on Volkswagen emitting and then some public, what would you call it, educational fund got money to tell you not to pollute, something like that. Do you guys think that there's anyone who was over-prosecuted on January 6th who deserves some form of redress?
Yeah. I don't know about like the exact redress, but I think the commutation of some of the long sentences, some of which I think were even, went further than what the government was asking for. But these, 22-year sentences for people, I get commuting those sentences. I don't get doing that for people who committed violence. And, something, maybe get the numbers wrong, but I think 600 odd of people there either pled guilty or convicted of actual violence. And it's like, you did the violence. That's a huge deal at a time when we have a lot of political violence in this country, more than we should have, let's say, at the very least. And you're not going to produce a less violent politics if you're just out there pardoning one side, which is what they did. So, yeah, to some degree, be open to it. If there was some egregious case of this, be open to settlement money. I guess I can't necessarily name one. But I think it just went way overboard with pardoning people who did violence. You could have just not done that.
Yeah. And there was some unconscionable lengthy pretrial detention. But the problem there is unconscionably lengthy pretrial detention, not in this specific case. Kids who are accused of stealing a catalytic converter that was improperly secured get that, too. And that's where the reform should be.
Yeah. And also, and let's shout out to Clark Neely, the ever sour Clark Neely, who we love. But he always points out, like, yeah, you're shocked that 98% of these cases plead out. And they plead out because we have a system that has just allowed prosecutors to say, okay, we're going to imprison you for 100 years unless you plead guilty. And we're just going to stack charges on you and do the RICO and all of that. So that's also part of the underlying problem here. Now, I'm going to switch gears and go to our end of show cultural recommendations because I want to give us enough time to talk about how awesome the NBA playoffs are, since we have Pesca here. It's great. So my cultural recommendation is that the NBA playoffs are awesome. I want to tell a brief little anecdote because it's fun and cute and it's very New York, which is that on Thursday, the second game of the Knicks-Cavaliers series, which ended last night, on Thursday, walked down in my neighborhood. I was like, let's go to a sports bar and have a look at it. There's two sports bars on either side of the street. And both of them were too crowded. I'm claustrophobic. I'm like, okay. But then noticed that there was a dude as New York as can be who had parked an SUV and put a giant TV in it and just plopped down a couple of chairs. And that's where I watched the game. And it was awesome. And our friend, America's reporter, Nancy Rommelman, took a picture of it saying, hey, where are you watching the Knicks game? Great little photo that went viral. 11 million views of this photo. A result, we went there again last night and it was huge, packed out. There were reporters from the New York Post, People were bringing booze, the pizza slices, the cops were there. And it was just like such an awesome New York scene that made me feel great about America, as do the playoffs in general, including the Western Conference series. Catherine, I know that you've become an NBA expert, in case we're going to talk about the NBA. So I absolutely need to know what you can tell us about the sports ball.
Listen, I my husband is a huge NBA fan and a lifelong Knicks fan. Oh. He is a long-suffering Knicks fan, and so he is excited about what's happening. I asked him what I should say on the podcast, and he talked for like a really long time and said a lot of things that sounded really smart. But the thing that I took away was we are objectively pro-cartels. The NBA is a cartel. They sort of kind of have an exemption to antitrust. Matt, you've written about this with baseball. And this is a great example of why there should be antitrust laws are bad, because all these exciting turns of events are possible due to a wildly cartel-like, locked down, hyper-collaborative behavior on the part of all the teams in the league. And that just makes good fun for everyone. We love cartels. That's what I have for you guys.
Wow.
What do you think?
Nick, do you have libertarian lessons about Victor Wembanyama?
Well, you know, I mean, the NBA is interesting from a kind of market perspective because it is a cartel and it's also got salary caps and kind of socialized earnings and things like that.
But so they make that's the top level. Holy cow. Those are some salary.
Yeah, yeah, no. Well, and also, you know, arguably the NBA has the best players union. They've done the most for their players, I think, in terms of salary and fringe benefits and kind of keeping the pipeline, the talent pipeline at just the right level to keep new stars emerging as they need them.
Heard a lot of stuff about Victor Wembanyama's compensation. Mm-hmm. There were some words about that, but I don't remember what they were.
Yeah.
He's being paid not a lot, but that's good.
For me, the biggest problem, and I believe Catherine's husband is too young to remember the last time the Knicks actually won a title. Yes. And Lord knows the last
1973.
He's too young, right? Yeah.
He's too young to have
experience. Very good. And the last time that the Knicks were in a final, if I'm remembering correctly, there is a big, it's never a good thing for America when the Knicks are in the final. But all I'm going to say, Matt, in the interest of time, is that unfortunately, particularly in New York, the Knicks being in the finals has brought up a lot of conversations about their old championship teams. And people keep telling me how great Bill Bradley is as a basketball player, as a person, and as a senator. And I hate Bill Bradley. He was a senator from New Jersey. And I went to a high school journalism thing that he put together at Monmouth College, now Monmouth University, in Long Branch, New Jersey. And he kept interrupting our meals to make really shitty Bruce Springsteen jokes where he would be like, well, I guess I've talked long enough now and everybody's got a hungry heart. Let's have lunch.
Oh, God.
And he is so awful as a human being. Bill Bradley, the worst.
Wow. Pesca, equal time.
Is Chris Christie better? I mean, he's what's he going to reference? 57 channels and nothing on?
Nobody is constantly telling me that Chris Christie is the best.
Yeah.
You know?
Bill Bradley was not a good pro. I mean, maybe he was a good pro, but given his draft position, given his transcendence at Princeton, given the fact that he was the subject of a great profile.
No, it's not a great profile. And the book is terrible. John McPhee is also one of the worst overwriters in American history.
No one knows because no one's ever finished one of his articles, right? Yeah. They do go on forever. So I'm in this weird position of I'm a New York sports fan, brought up as such. And so outsiders will say, well, you've had your share of championships, Mike. But in New York, because it is the largest and best city in America, you always have a choice of who to choose for. And I have chosen wrong, or at least the choices were imposed upon me by my parentage. So Giants have won some Super Bowls in my lifetime. I am a Jets fan. And the Yankees have won several world championships. I am a Mets fan. And, well, does hockey even exist?
Are you an Islanders fan, right?
I am. You know, when I grew up on Long Island.
You've got your little Dennis Potvin's jersey that you can't wear outside?
Oh, no.
I caught this at an Islanders game after it bounced off.
Listeners, he's holding up a puck.
For the New York Islanders.
Pretty awesome puck, actually.
Okay, so that was fun, but I have had really no fun. St. John's fan, huge St. John's fan. They're my number one team in all sports. So as a Knicks fan and a Mets fan, one world championship and a Jets fan, nothing. I have been on the shit end of the sports stick. And I don't think this is going to change. I think there are two Western Conference opponents, but it's just so much fun to root for teams that can win and are winning versus teams that can't and aren't. The orange and blue of the co-orange and blue of the Mets is my example. It's going to be a great time in New York City. And you know what? It is a Rocky Balboa underdog story, because if you remember in Rocky, which is now Rocky One, all he said to Adrian beforehand was, "I want to go the distance." And at the end, as he's hugging Adrian, they read the score and Apollo Creed beats him 2-1, judge's decision. But if the Knicks go the distance and bring it to 7 games, I think that's all we could ask for.
What kind of New Yorker are you that you're invoking an urtext of Philadelphia, which has its own debased fan culture, Mike? Yeah. That you're a New Yorker and you're likening it to... New York's like Rocky. The Knicks have already lost. They're out in four, Matt.
Because of this, yes.
Let's bounce from the NBA. And Catherine, what did you consume besides the NBA?
I read Iron John, A Book About Men by Robert Bly.
Wow.
This is a classic of the, go yell in the woods to get in touch with your masculinity again. I read a book about women's archetypes, and then I read a book about men's archetypes called Magician, Lover, Warrior, King. And then I was like, all right, I'm on a roll. I'm going to read some Robert Bly. I now know everything about men. Between my knowledge about the NBA and this book, I am ready to interact with the other half of the species and to know things. No, it was really actually it's genuinely interesting because it provides, I think, a really useful counterpart to the manosphere of today. This is not recognizably a thing that became the Jordan Peterson of it all. This is not recognizably a thing that became the clavicular of it all. It's a very different thing, but it is anti the feminization of men. It is very much not. I think I imagined there might be more like we're yelling in the woods to get in touch with our feelings, but we're not. We're yelling in the woods to get in touch with our like masculine desire for violence. And I think I really appreciated that and found it interesting. And I'm really on a roll with the archetypes, the gender archetypes these days. So you will be hearing more from me about that.
Fun fact.
Can I ask real quick, yeah. Catherine, can you at all, and I know this is, just off the cuff, but can you draw a line between Robert Bly to the kind of lumber sexual alt-right of people like Matt Walsh, not Matt Welch, but Matt Walsh and, Tucker Carlson, who anywhere he goes, he's wrapped with, in pine. A pine cabin somewhere, and he's probably using Sasquatch pine tar deodorant and everything like that. Because it seems like there's a connection to being in the woods, but today's alt-right, and forget the prissiness of a Jordan Peterson or the nattiness of somebody like Ben Shapiro, who just isn't really masculine in any kind of recognizable sense. Yeah, but Bly is kind of like, he's like brawny. He was hanging out with Brawny, the paper towel guy, and Dinty Moore, in that drum circle. And now you have people like Matt Walsh, whose beard keeps getting longer and his plaid keeps getting thicker.
Yeah, I feel like you might be like slightly overvaluing just the flannel element of all this. Like, I know that there is a lot of flannel in this story, but there is a line. Another book I read, which I wasn't even going to mention because I hated it so bad, but I will, is The Way of the Superior Man by David Dida. It's apparently a classic. It's been around for 20 years. It's the idiot version of this. So it's if we kind of have the, all right, we got a bunch of hippie dudes in the 70s. They might have gotten a little too in touch with their feminine side. They're having trouble individuating from their mothers. It's all Jungian. It's all Freudian. And then we have this book, which is like, He-Man good. Women's words mean nothing. Listen not to words. Feel only feelings of women. Women are not for words. It's terrible. And then somewhere out of the far side of that, we get kind of the Manosphere and Jordan Peterson, which is, it's just, it's all a very interesting flow. I do think it is all an attempt to figure out what to do with masculinity and mm-hmm. especially the male urge to be violent and to do violence for some productive end, like hunting or whatever, that doesn't have good outlets in the modern world and doesn't have good ways of channeling those impulses. All these people are trying to figure out how to do this. Yes, there seems to be a lot of flannel, but I don't know that that's the linchpin of the thing.
I once got really wasted with Robert Bly in 1990s Prague. Catherine, you'll be happy to know.
And, oh my God, Matt. And we're doing a whole special episode of the podcast where you just talk about this.
I don't remember anything about it.
Oh, no.
But he was tall and we were in Old Town Square and there was some boisterous, like tally-ho type of singing.
And you when know, you woke up, you were naked from the waist down, but wearing flannel.
Yes.
But, you know, it is also interesting. Bly is one of the end of a tradition of poets, and I like modern post-war poets who were male and aggressively masculine. And, you know, this includes James Dickey, who wrote the novel Deliverance, as well as people like Robert Creeley and Charles Olson and whatnot, like where you could be a poet, which is the feminist of possible, but you know, literary positions now, but be a man's man.
Well, and the book is, you know, Iron John. We stop periodically to retell the myth of Iron John, this kind of wild man story. And we stop periodically for Robert Bly's poetry. And perhaps even more impressive, for Robert Bly's middling translations of other people's great works of poetry. And it pulled me up short every single time because of the, I think because of this stereotype that I have of like, what is this man trying to reclaim manly manness doing, popping in for a little poetry about the trees? But his whole thesis is like, it is one and the same.
All right, Nick, quickly now, please. Yeah. What did you consume?
I read Emancipation War.
Woohoo!
The Fall of Slavery and the Coming of the 13th Amendment by Reason's own Damon Root. I will point out somehow he forgot to mention he works for Reason in his bio on the back of this book.
It's weird how you from Potomac Books. That.
Yeah,
he wrote it while he was not working for Reason.
He's publishing it when he's working for Reason. But Emancipation War is a fantastic, succinct read about how the Civil War started, at least under Lincoln, it started as a war about maintaining the Union and very quickly became a war about ending slavery everywhere. And it opens with a kind of explanation about how in 1861, Abraham Lincoln, as he was taking power as president, talked about how he was ready to vote for the 13th Amendment, the proposed 13th Amendment in front of him, which would have barred the federal government from ever mucking with slavery in the states. And then just a few years later was pushing what became the 13th Amendment, which was to ban forever slavery in all the states and any of the possessions now and forever. Amen. Fantastic read and just a wonderful contribution to general conversations about history in America and what matters, but also of Damon's work on, kind of the Civil War and the Reconstruction and the way that Lincoln and people like Frederick Douglass really speak to contemporary matters about American identity and American inclusion.
Pesca, based on last experience, I'm limiting you to one recommendation. You tried to smuggle in five last time. So what?
You got it.
One thing that you
being succinct. Can I just point out, though, that I think Brawny was a masculine reaction to Bounty and Rosie the Waitress, so it wasn't really...
No, but it was also Rosie Greer was right. Also a Bounty, the quicker picker upper pitch man, and he, of course, did Needlepoint and sang It's Okay to Cry. So
Right, Free to Be You and Me.
Which is a Brawny song.
Brawny is the antithesis. I don't know what the synthesis is because I buy generic paper tape. Paper towels.
That's right. It's very Hegelian, my paper towel consumption. Colbert went off the air. Everything to be said about that has been said. Losing a lot of money. Very predictable. Kind of sad still on some ways. Colbert Report, great show. I'm speaking of or thinking of a segment he did a couple weeks before going off the air. I think this is true. Ed Edward Norton, the actor, who I find to be not a terrible actor, but kind of a supercilious, hard to take guy in real life, did something great on late night television. And he did a recitation of the Walt Whitman poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. He didn't read the whole poem. I think he included some other parts of it. So I read all of Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. I almost never regret reading Walt Whitman. And this time I didn't either. The one part of Crossing Brooklyn Ferry I knew was there was a reference to the ample hills of Brooklyn, and that created an overly sweet ice cream company yep. that went belly up and then was reconstituted and I think went belly up again. They had, oh no, I don't want to smuggle in another recommendation.
You're doing it.
The craziest podcast.
This is already
podcast.
Four. Yeah.
Really? This yeah. counts?
The Colbert, craziest podcast. Whitman, oh.
What is it?
Ice
is
cream.
It the ice cream or getting, is it Walt Whitman
I'm
or
getting
Ed Norton
to my,
or Steve Colbert?
All right. It's definitely not Norton. Yeah, it's Walt Whitman. It's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. I'm just telling you how I got there. Well, I do it without even trying to do it. I'm sorry. I hyperlink as I speak.
Yes,
my bad.
That is fantastic. Thank you.
It's That's also great. Worth pointing out that Whitman, though, ended up in Camden, New Jersey.
Yeah. Why is that worth pointing out?
There's so much poetry in today's recommendations. I love it.
I was feeling like it was an NBA thing because the Sixers, every time they need a new contract or something from Philly, they always threaten to move to Camden.
That's true.
And this is one place where Philadelphia is like, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. You can play in the New Jersey Aquarium.
I swear to God, that's all the time that we have for the Reason Roundtable podcast. I believe Peter Suderman will be back from vacation next week. Let's hope. And thanks for listening to all of it. We'll be back on Monday, not Tuesday. Happy Memorial Day. If you like what we do, you can go to reason.com/donate and give us all your cash dollar bills. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of the Western Conference Finals and also the NBA Finals, which will be very nice. And I highly recommend going to Prince Pizzeria on Smith Street in Brooklyn. Goodbye.